Hi class, this is your professor, Dr. Fields. We are now going to be talking about personality disorders. I have two videos that illustrate two different personality disorders that I want you to take a look at first, and then you can resume with the audio lecture. Okay, now that you've seen those videos, we're now going to start talking about personality disorders. These kinds of disorders are more pervasive in theory than the other disorders, in the sense that they represent an inherently dysfunctional character or identity, as opposed to the other disorders that are acquired more in a sense. Okay? So, in other words, the other disorders we talked about, the anxiety disorders, depressive disorders, eating disorders, all those different kinds of disorders, the person acquires that. It doesn't become, it's not who they are, it's a condition they have. But a personality disorder essentially affects who the person is as a person, their identity, okay? People with personality disorders do not seek out treatment as much as people with other disorders because since personality disorders affects the whole person, it's hard for them to be objective and really acknowledge that they have this highly pathological condition, or at least to acknowledge the degree or extent of this condition. It really it consumes their whole being, so to speak, and not consumes their being as they're being they're feeling like they're being taken over by someone like an alien or something, but just it just becomes more an inherent part of their character, and so it's hard for them to remove themselves from that and look at themselves more objectively. So many people with personality disorders do not seek out treatment. There is one disorder where they do readily seek out treatment, borderline personality disorder. We're going to talk about that in a little bit, but there's a lot of controversy with that disorder. A lot of people think that that is more of a cluster of symptoms due to childhood abuse, but we'll talk more about that later. Okay? So it is often hard for people with PD or personality disorder to acknowledge that there is something wrong with them, whereas people with the other disorders we talked about readily acknowledge that there is something wrong with them. Even people with psychotic disorders, eventually will become medicated, or even without medication, the psychotic disorder will go in remittance from time to time. And during those times when they're not psychotic, they certainly are able to acknowledge that they have this very debilitating disorder. So other people are more likely to acknowledge that there is something wrong with a person with personality disorder. So it's very interesting, whereas the people that have the other disorders we talked about are more ready to acknowledge that there's something wrong with them. They have this, condition. People with personality disorders, other people are more apt to point out that there's something pathological with this person. And, we hear a lot of lay people use terms like, that person is a narcissist and so forth, in the common nomenclature that people use, right? So that really speaks to the tendency for other people to notice these conditions sooner and more so than the person that actually has them. Okay? PDs have a high rate of comorbidity. So in other words, if you have one personality disorder, there's a good chance you will have another one. And or they can morph into one another. So, you may start off having a narcissistic personality disorder, and that may eventually morph or change into antisocial personality disorder. So, again, whereas the other psychological disorders cause the patient distress, personality disorders usually cause other people distress. And so essentially, they all significantly adversely impact interpersonal relationships. That is common to all of them. And, either for the person or for the other people, and tend to begin in childhood. So they are chronic conditions. They're not easy to fix, for lack of a better way of saying it. They usually require a lot more therapy because they're so much more pervasive than the other disorders. Okay, so there are essentially three clusters of personality disorders. Cluster A includes odd or eccentric personality types, paranoid, schizoid, and schizotypal. Okay. And cluster B includes personality types that are dramatic, emotional, or erratic. They include antisocial, borderline, histrionic, and narcissistic personality disorders. And cluster C includes those that present as anxious or fearful types. And that cluster includes dependent, obsessive compulsive, and avoidant personality disorder. Obsessive compulsive personality disorder is similar in a lot of ways to obsessive compulsive disorder, but it is also different. And that will cause you some confusion, I'm sure, but hopefully I'll be able to clarify that when we get to that disorder. Okay, so let's look at some prevalence rates. I'm not going to go through all these prevalence rates. If you just kind of do a quick survey here, you can see that personality disorders on the whole are pretty rare, right? You see a lot of these rates with, between 1 to 2%, okay? And they tend to be fairly evenly distributed among the genders. For some, it will be like a slightly higher rate for females, a slightly higher rate for males. But they're fairly evenly distributed among the population. Okay. The one number that will jump out at you is the borderline rate, and that's 28%, but that's 28% in clinical population. So out of people who are getting some kind of psychological or psychiatric treatment, 28% of those consumers of mental health services are borderline. And the reason why we have that statistic and not the one for general population is because we still don't have any good estimates about that on the whole. Okay? But right off the bat, I will tell you that that does seem like a large number. Almost a third of the people that seek our services are borderline. That is the one disorder that is the exception rather than the rule in terms of the other one, in terms of, what we discussed previously, that these people do tend to seek out services a lot, unlike the other personality disorders. Okay. Now we're going to start talking about each of the personality disorders. And, I structured this lecture a little bit differently than the other ones. I wanted to go one by one rather than talking about them collectively because they are all so different from one another. Okay? So the first three we're going to talk about pertain to cluster A. The clusters are just important in the sense that, there are some commonalities of the personality disorders within each cluster, in regards to what we said before. But other than that, they certainly have distinct differences. So, paranoid personality disorder. If we look at the criteria on slide 5, this is a pervasive distrust and suspiciousness of others such that their motives are interpreted as malevolent, beginning by early childhood and present, I'm sorry, early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts, as indicated by four or more of the following, these different symptoms. Suspects without sufficient basis that others are exploiting, harming or deceiving him or her, is preoccupied with unjustified doubts about the loyalty or trustworthiness of friends or associates, is reluctant to confide in others because of unwarranted fear that the information will be used maliciously against him or her, reads hidden demeaning or threatening meanings into benign remarks or events, persistently bears grudges, is unforgiving of insults, injuries, or slights, perceives attacks on his or her character or reputation that are not apparent to others, and is quick to react angrily or to counterattack, and has recurrent suspicions without justification regarding fidelity of spouse or sexual partner. And then we have the rule out there that this is not due to these other kinds of conditions. Okay? All right, so you're going to see that for a lot of these different disorders, there, and as with all the different disorders, there is evidence of a genetic predisposition. Some psychological evidence, or I should say this, that's pretty much the only biological evidence that exists for paranoid personality disorder, just that there is some biological evidence of a genetic predisposition. Some psychological evidence exists that these individuals have had early childhood experiences that includes trauma and or mistreatment, which would make sense given their paranoid disposition. According to cognitive behavioral therapy theory, these people have a schema or general belief system that revolves around the thought people cannot be trusted. Okay? We haven't talked a lot about schemas, but in cognitive therapy, you know, we have these distorted or irrational thoughts that we're trying to target in our patients, right? Well, these distorted and irrational thoughts are generated from a more general personal philosophy or belief system that's very dysfunctional that these people have, okay? And so for people with paranoid personality disorder, you know, their personal belief system is that people cannot be trusted. Okay? Okay, so how do we treat paranoid personality disorder? You're going to see this a lot as far as medical treatments go. In many of these disorders, medication is only indirectly effective in the sense that it can be helpful in addressing other disorders that this person may have, like let's say they have anxiety, a depression, or a substance use disorder, but it's not very effective for addressing the fundamental symptoms of the actual personality disorder. Okay? Psychological interventions would involve any therapeutic technique that can focus first and foremost on building rapport and trust between the therapist and patient. Almost all therapeutic techniques rely on rapport and a good alliance between the therapist and the patient. So any psychological or psychotherapeutic technique can be effective because through the therapeutic relationship, the person can learn to trust people, starting with the therapist. More specifically, cognitive behavioral therapy can additionally target the dysfunctional, unhealthy schema that we just talked about and related thoughts. So really challenging this idea that no one can be trusted, right? To try to show them that, you know, some people can't be trusted, sure, but many people can. Okay, going on to schizoid personality disorder. This is a pervasive pattern of detachment from social relationships and a restricted range of expression of emotions in interpersonal settings, beginning by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts. I mentioned before that a lot of these start in childhood. That means that, you know, people will start to display some symptoms, but by early adulthood is usually when they meet full criteria. Just to explain that disparity there. So some of these symptoms include not desiring or enjoying close relationships, including being part of their own family, almost always choosing solitary activities, has little if any interest in having sexual experiences with another person, takes pleasure in few if any activities, lacks close friends or confidants other than first degree relatives, appears indifferent to the praise or criticism of others, shows emotional coldness, detachment, or flattened affectivity, okay? And then criterion B is the rule out. So, a real detachment from people is what defines that disorder. So, as far as the causes go, there is very little research on biological factors, but because it shares a close relationship to autism spectrum disorder in terms of that social detachment, right, which also goes hand in hand with social skill deficits, that implies that there may indeed exist some kinds of biological underpinnings to this disorder, but we don't know of any as of yet. That may change. Some psychological evidence does exist for childhood abuse and/or neglect being associated with this disorder, and the trait of shyness being a precursor to this disorder. Okay? According to cognitive theory, for this disorder, these people have a schema or general belief system that revolves around the thought relationships can cause problems. So relationships are messy, they can cause problems, so basically they're a negative thing, and that's why I don't want anything to do with people. Okay? Treatment. Again, medical treatments are only effective indirectly in regards to treating other disorders or symptoms. As far as psychological interventions go, cognitive behavioral therapy that focuses on combating the dysfunctional, unhealthy schema and related thoughts that we talked about can be helpful, as well as teaching and practicing social skills that, along with the experience of the therapeutic relationship, can help these people see the benefit of social relationships. And this general kind of benefit can be accomplished by pretty much all therapy techniques because all therapy involves a relationship, the therapeutic relationship. This is very similar to people with autism spectrum disorder. Sometimes, or I should say, many times, they need to experience a social relationship to understand the benefit of it. So, that once they start experiencing a social relationship and the pleasure of having one or some of the benefits of having one, even if they're more perceived as superficial benefits, any benefit at all that they perceive, will kind of counter that idea that they don't need people or that relationships, do not provide any positives. So therapy can be kind of like their first close relationship to show them the benefits of having a close, connected, interpersonal relationship. Okay? Interpersonal therapy, which is a type of psychodynamic therapy, would also be an approach that could really potentially help these people because, again, with that approach, the emphasis is on developing healthy social relationships. Okay? Okay, the last one out of cluster A is schizotypal personality disorder. This is a pervasive pattern of social and interpersonal deficits marked by acute discomfort with and reduced capacity for close relationships, as well as by cognitive or perceptual distortions and eccentricities of behavior, beginning by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts, as indicated by five or more of the following. Ideas of reference, which do not rise to the level of delusions of reference, so they're not psychotic, but they're like psychotic-like, right? They're those subclinical levels that we talked about with the prodromal stage of schizophrenia. Okay? Odd beliefs or magical thinking that influences behavior and is inconsistent with subcultural norms, such as, maybe they are very superstitious or they have a belief in that they have clairvoyance or telepathy or a sixth sense. In children and adolescents, it could be bizarre fantasies or preoccupations. They have unusual perceptual experiences, including bodily illusions, odd thinking and speech, which is vague, circumstantial, metaphorical, over-elaborate or stereotyped, suspiciousness or paranoid ideation, inappropriate or constricted affect, affect having to do with mood. Inappropriate, we talked about before, like laughing at a time when you shouldn't be laughing, right? Constricted affect is not having much emotional expression. Their behavior appearance is often eccentric or odd or weird. They have a lack of close friends or confidants other than first degree relatives. And there is excessive social anxiety that does not diminish with familiarity and tends to be associated with paranoid fears rather than negative judgments about self. So, different from social anxiety disorder, these people have a lot of social anxiety because they're paranoid of other people. Schizoid personality disorder is where people, they're detached from people and they seem to be okay with it, right? They're just like, yeah, I don't mind being a loner, I'm fine. Whereas schizotypal personality disorder, you get a sense that they would like to make connections with other people, but they just have such a hard time connecting because they have a lot of these kind of bizarre thoughts and bizarre behaviors, and that causes other people to kind of shy away from them. And then they also have some paranoia about other people and their intentions and what have you. So it's just very difficult for them to connect to other people. Not necessarily that they don't have a desire to, as in schizoid personality disorder. Okay? So you might be already correctly jumping to the conclusion that sometimes, people with schizotypal personality disorder, can be misdiagnosed, right? In the sense that, you may think that this is a person who's eventually going to develop schizophrenia, they have those subclinical levels, and that they're in a prodromal stage. And so, basically, how do you differentiate the two? Well, it's kind of simple, actually. If the person never develops full-blown schizophrenia, then they have schizotypal personality disorder, with those subclinical levels, right? They're not so psychotic features, right? They're like subclinical psychotic features. So if they never develop schizophrenia, then they have schizotypal personality disorder. And if they develop schizophrenia, then they have schizophrenia, right? If they develop full-blown psychotic features, then they have schizophrenia. So that's the main difference between those two. So, there is some evidence of biological factors, such as a more general genetic susceptibility to both schizophrenia and schizotypal personality disorder, which makes sense given what I just said, right? Because they are so similar in a lot of ways. Also, there is some evidence that exists for brain abnormalities, possibly with the left hemisphere in particular, so possibly showing some abnormalities in the left hemisphere. And there is some psychological evidence for severe childhood maltreatment, at least for men. And from a cognitive behavioral therapy perspective, these people would have a schema or general belief system that revolves around the thought it is not beneficial to be around others. In other words, if you're looking at it from a cost-benefit analysis, while they may secretly or inherently want to connect to other people, they just think it's just too difficult, right? It's just too difficult. I'm too different from these people. And it's probably gonna wind up bad for me trying to reach out and connect to other people because I'll be rejected, or they'll take advantage of me, or it just won't be a good thing. Okay? Treatments. Antipsychotic medication in particular can be used to treat their mild or subclinical psychotic-like symptoms, as well as other related disorders or symptoms. So, then of course you could use antidepressants to treat other symptoms such as depression if they also have that. As far as psychological interventions, cognitive behavioral therapy would focus on teaching them social skills and then having them practice the social skills with the therapist. And ultimately, this and the experience of the therapeutic relationship can help these people see the great benefit of social relationships because, a lot of these people understand that there could be a benefit to social relationships, but they don't understand just how beneficial it could be. And again, all therapy techniques can accomplish this general goal of having a person experience a close interpersonal relationship and then being able to see the benefit of it. And then, so by having these experiences, these can indirectly change their unhealthy schema along with more direct disputation of any related thoughts. So, challenging any kind of thoughts in terms of them thinking that it's not going to be that beneficial to have to connect with other people, or thinking that, other people are going to have bad intentions or things of that nature. And, with the social skills training, because, listen, they're not completely, off base by trying to avoid social relationships, because they do act and behave oddly, and they do have some odd or unusual thoughts. And so they will get rejected by a lot of people. So cognitive behavioral therapy can also teach them that, hey, while you have these ideas, or you have this, tendency to engage in these kind of odd behaviors, here's the thing. Keep that to yourself because you may indeed have a difficult time connecting with others if, you kind of, reveal all of these behaviors, at least too soon. Maybe once you have established a close relationship, then you can slowly let these people into your world and know the true you and all about you. But probably not best to, let all of you out of the bag so soon. Okay. So that concludes cluster A personality disorders. Now we're going to discuss cluster B. I think these are the most interesting. It's just my opinion. Hollywood tends to, really jump on these conditions as well, because they are, very dramatic kinds of conditions, right? So I find them very fascinating. And there are four of them in this cluster. The first one is antisocial personality disorder. We're going to spend a bit more time on this one and borderline personality disorder for no other reason other than they're both very, very fascinating. And then because borderline personality disorder tends to be a disorder where people do actually seek treatment for. And it is a very hard one for therapists to deal with. Okay? Okay, so antisocial personality disorder entails a pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others occurring since age 15 years, as indicated by three or more of the following. So, right off the bat, this should sound kind of familiar to one of the childhood disorders we discussed, which is conduct disorder. Okay? This involves a failure to conform to social norms with respect to lawful behaviors, as indicated by repeatedly performing acts that are grounds for arrest, so criminal behavior. Deceitfulness, as indicated by repeatedly lying, use of aliases, or conning others for personal profit or pleasure. Impulsivity or failure to plan ahead, irritability and aggressiveness, as indicated by repeated physical fights or assaults, reckless disregard for safety of self or others, consistent irresponsibility, as indicated by repeated failure to sustain consistent work behavior or honor financial obligations, and lack of remorse as indicated by being indifferent to or rationalizing having hurt, mistreated, or stolen from another. The individual must be at least 18 years of age. If they have these traits and they're younger than 18 years of age, then they would be diagnosed with conduct disorder. Okay? And in fact, there needs to be evidence of conduct disorder before, with onset before age 15 years before we can diagnose antisocial personality disorder. Okay? So, in other words, this doesn't occur all of a sudden in adulthood. This starts from very early on. And then D is our rule out there. Okay. So I created the next diagram on slide 15. And the reason why I did is because I want to point out that antisocial personality disorder is not necessarily synonymous with being a criminal. Okay? So for one, many criminals do not have antisocial personality disorder. Most of them do, and most people who are in prison, a large majority of the people who are in prison, would meet criteria for antisocial personality disorder. But there are certainly people who commit crimes out of impulsivity or under the influence of drugs or alcohol, that don't have antisocial personality disorder. You know, they made a mistake, so to speak, okay? So that was the one thing I wanted to mention first and foremost. The other thing I want to mention is that not all people with antisocial personality disorder become criminals. You know, they usually become lawyers. No, it's a horrible, horrible joke. Or they work for insurance companies. Bad jokes, bad jokes. But no, seriously, not all people with antisocial personality disorder become criminals. So if you go back to the criteria on slide 14, you will see that you could meet criteria for antisocial personality disorder without ever engaging in criminal behavior, right? So, for example, you could have the symptom of deceitfulness as indicated by repeatedly lying, right? You could have impulsivity and a failure to plan ahead, okay? You could have a reckless disregard for your own safety, and you could have consistent irresponsibility as indicated by repeated failure to sustain consistent work behavior or honor financial obligations. And you could also have a lack of remorse for when you mistreat people, right? It's not illegal to mistreat people, okay? So what I'm saying is that there are a lot of people walking around with antisocial personality disorder who have never committed a crime and who are not in prison, okay? And you know, I was joking before about, you know, lawyers and insurance agents, but you know, there are some professionals, right, that, you know, will engage in these kinds of, you know, do have this kind of personality disorder where they're always trying to, you know, take advantage of other people. And you could, you know, use your imagination in terms of, you know, what kinds of professions you might find some people like this in, where, you know, they can, you know, get the financial benefit of taking advantage of people. Like, you know, maybe in the field of being a stockbroker or something of that nature, where, you know, you can, you know, mislead people in terms of their investments so that you can get a financial gain from it, that kind of thing. Okay? So not all people with antisocial personality disorder are criminals. But all people with antisocial personality disorder are antisocial and care more about themselves than others. That's for sure. That's what they all have in common. So when we look at this chart here, right? So this first big circle here is like all people with antisocial personality disorder. And then this medium-sized circle, it represents a good proportion of people with antisocial personality disorder being criminals. And then a very small minority of those people turning out to be serial killers. Why do I include serial killers? Because they fascinate me. For no other reason. They really fascinate me. There could be a case where there's a serial killer that didn't have antipersonality disorder. Maybe like we talked about when we were talking about the sexual disorders, they could have a paraphiliac disorder where they can only get sexual release from killing someone, but that would be really hard to make the case that they also wouldn't have antisocial personality disorder because, the fact that they acted on this when they know that how wrong it is, it would be hard not to diagnose a serial killer with antipersonality disorder. Let's just say that. So I would say all of them have it, pretty much. And there are a lot of other related terms that get thrown around there, psychopathy and sociopathy. Those are not terms, diagnostic terms that we use in the DSM. We use this term, which is antisocial personality disorder. And this really has more to do with behaviors, right? That we can observe that give us an indication of their type of personality, such as being, not being remorseful or not having empathy. Psychopathy is, more of, different kinds of personality traits that may or may not lead to behavior, okay? And sociopathy is just a more general term that basically is synonymous with antisocial personality disorder, where, one cares much more about themselves than other people. So for our purposes, we'll stick to the diagnostic term of antisocial personality disorder. So on the next slide, slide 16, I have these photos of famous serial killers. And just to kind of take a mental break here for a second, you can see how many of these you can identify on your own. All very famous serial killers. Most, if not all, of these have Netflix specials, I'm absolutely positive about, except for maybe a couple. But most of these have some kind of Netflix documentary about, because they are so famous and fascinating, just because, it's fascinating to people like me who are in this field of abnormal psychology about, what leads one to do these egregious acts repeatedly over and over. Okay, so that's enough time for that little quiz. On slide 17, here are the answers. The first row from left to right is David, son of Sam Berkowitz, Jeffrey Dahmer, John Wayne Gacy, and Edmund Kemper. The second row from left to right is Joel Rifkin. He was a very famous serial killer here in New York City. Ted Bundy, Dennis, BTK Raider. BTK stands for Bind, Torture, Kill. That was basically what he did with his victims. And Eileen Wuornos, she was in that film Monster that Charlize Theron played the part of. Very interesting film if you haven't seen that. So, what causes antisocial personality disorder? We're not going to talk specifically about what causes the more specific subtype of people becoming serial killers. That could be a course unto itself. But just in general, what causes antisocial personality disorder? There exists some evidence of biological factors such as a genetic predisposition or vulnerability, okay, like with many of the disorders. And also, which is very interesting, reduced physiological arousal, which is evidenced in lower skin conductance, a slower heartbeat, and more slow frequency brain waves, so that their arousal is lower. They don't tend to get as aroused or as frazzled by other people. So, it's almost like the complete opposite of a person with an anxiety disorder, right? So a person with anxiety disorder gets aroused very easily, Okay, they're always walking around in a state of hyperarousal. These people walk around in a state of hypoarousal, right? They don't tend to get aroused easily, which can be scary because things that should make you anxious, like committing crimes, don't seem to make these people anxious. Okay, psychological factors that have been found include less sensitivity to the effects of punishment or lack of reward or reinforcement. So they just don't seem to be as bothered by punishment or by not being reinforced or getting a reward. Cognitive behavioral therapy would postulate that they possess an unhealthy schema related to I am special. And thus, I'm sorry, and thus can do what I want, even if that means breaking rules. So the rules don't apply to me. I can do whatever I want. People, I don't care about people. I don't care about rules. Basically, I don't care about consequences. Also, during childhood, poor parenting practices such as coercive or forceful discipline, neglect, which basically is just not caring what the kid does, and giving in to poor behaviors, which is basically inconsistent and harsh parenting, right? So a lot of these parents, they'll either be neglectful at times where they just don't care, or they'll give in to poor behaviors, like stop with your tirade of tantrum, Johnny, here's some ice cream or here's a toy, or they'll be very harsh. With basically physically abusing the student, the child, to discipline them. Okay, and so they'll, these different parenting practices will be used at varying times, but inconsistently. There's not one type that they use consistently, and they're all unhealthy kinds of parenting practices, and these have all been found to relate to this disorder. Other factors such as academic difficulty, peer problems, and low socioeconomic status are also associated with this disorder. Again, associated, not that it necessarily causes it. This disorder, then, because we have so much evidence of these childhood factors, has a particularly sensitive developmental period in early childhood. Okay, so that if it doesn't develop in early childhood, there's a very good chance it's not going to develop. As such, the more long-standing and ingrained these behavioral difficulties become during one's youth, the more probability that this person will advance to the more severe antisocial personality disorder. So when we are looking at these three kinds of disorders, the two that are diagnosed in childhood, oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorder, and antisocial personality disorder being diagnosed in adulthood, you can see that these three disorders really represent a progression of essentially the same kind of psychological disorder. That if oppositional defiant disorder is not treated effectively or just gets worse, it can become conduct disorder. And if that is not treated early enough on in childhood or just gets worse, that can eventually become antisocial personality disorder. Okay? So, going back to those different serial killers, like one of the documentaries about Ted Bundy, it's very interesting because for the longest time, people thought Ted Bundy was such an anomaly. His childhood seemed to be perfect and like he had no issues. And then all of a sudden, it came out, well, I shouldn't say all of a sudden, then eventually it came out that he did experience a lot of childhood abuse. I believe it was by his grandfather, and a lot of rejection by peers. And so he didn't have the picture perfect childhood that a lot of people thought. For the longest time, he was kind of like an anomaly. Like, how did he become a serial killer? If this is what's typical for people with antisocial personality disorder. So he fits the mold, so to speak. So treatment for these kinds of conditions, especially antisocial personality disorder. Medication, again, only indirectly effective in regard to treating any other disorders that these individuals may have. They often have substance use disorder. Certainly that they can be helpful for treating that, but not very helpful for directly treating the symptoms of antisocial personality disorder. A lot of these people will not go to therapy. They have, they don't feel like they have a need to go to therapy. So the only way most of these people wind up in therapy is from an external motivation, such as a court saying you need to go to therapy or you will go to jail, or maybe a spouse, or somebody else saying that, a job saying like, you've mistreated so many of these, fellow coworkers, and either you get some kind of therapy or you're out. That's usually the way they wind up in therapy. Other than that, they don't tend to seek it out. So if they were in therapy, what would we do? We would try to modify their unhealthy schema and related thoughts, right? And for children, now this is really the most important. If you're dealing with an adult who has antisocial personality disorder, I have to tell you, I'm very pessimistic about the prognosis. However, for a young child, if they get therapy early on enough and their family, it can lead to some potentially remarkable changes. So you could essentially prevent a child from growing up and becoming a criminal or even worse. And what you do is you would teach the child, other cognitive behavioral skills such as consequential thinking, really understanding that, if they break rules or they do bad things, bad things are going to happen to them. And then the parents need to learn, most importantly, effective discipline practices, positively reinforcing good behavior and appropriately punishing bad behavior. And also, if they neglect the child, they have to learn that, they are key in terms of, changing this child's developmental trajectory, that they, really have to work on bonding with the child and forming a close, healthy relationship with the child. Otherwise, the child grows up not really caring about people, right? Because they haven't experienced being cared for or haven't experienced a caring relationship. And so, in that sense, family and systems therapy can be very helpful for just changing the overall unhealthy dynamic and interpersonal pattern among all family members. These kids don't just have conflictive relationships with their parents, they also have conflictive relationships with their siblings, so the whole family really needs to be treated. Okay? All right. On to the next biggie, so to speak. Borderline personality disorder. Now, I said before, this has been kind of a controversial disorder because, again, a lot of us are not so sold on it being a personality disorder as it being just a cluster of symptoms like post-traumatic stress disorder that represent child abuse. Okay, because so many people with BDP have experienced some pretty severe childhood abuse. So this entails a pervasive pattern of instability of interpersonal relationships, self-image and affects, moods, and marked impulsivity beginning by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts as indicated by five or more of the following. Frantic efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment, a pattern of unstable and intense interpersonal relationships characterized by alternating between extremes of idealization and devaluation. I essentially sum this up to, them being like, I need you, I need you, I need you. I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. Get away from me. Right? So they're constantly, going to the extreme. Either you are the best thing since sliced bread, or you are their arch enemy. And that, view can change within the course of a day. Okay. This also includes an identity disturbance. I would argue all the personality disorders include an identity disturbance, which has to do with markedly and persistently unstable self-image or sense of self, impulsivity in at least two areas that are potentially self-damaging: spending, sex, substance abuse, reckless driving, binge eating. Their impulsivity has more to do with, they're so distressed so much of the time that they have a tendency to kind of engage or overly engage in, pleasurable activities that can be potentially harmful because they are so desperate to make themselves feel better because they feel so distressed so much of the time. Okay? And their impulsivity with sex in particular is because they're so desperate for some kind of connection with somebody, and they will literally have sex with someone in the hopes that that will kind of keep that person in their life. By giving another person sex, that person will feel obligated, and then therefore they won't abandon them. This also presents with recurrent suicidal behavior, gestures or threats, or self-mutilating behavior such as cutting. A lot of times, because they are so distressed. And cutting behavior has been shown to basically give some kind of endorphin release. So it's a very unhealthy coping behavior that a lot of distressed individuals do, people with bipolar disorder or people with depression, to kind of make them feel something, okay? This also presents with affective or mood instability due to a marked reactivity of mood. They are, whereas people with schizoid personality disorder have a very restricted level of mood, right? They're not very reactive. People with borderline personality disorder are the complete opposite. They are very emotionally reactive. They have periods of intense dysphoria, irritability, anxiety, and they can even have intense episodes of euphoria, feeling, wonderful. Like if they feel that someone else cares about them, then they feel on top of the moon, okay? And that is why a lot of times people with borderline personality disorder are misdiagnosed as bipolar disorder. They also have chronic feelings of emptiness, inappropriate intense anger or difficulty controlling anger, especially towards other people. That, I mean, those are the individuals they are projecting the anger onto. Whenever they feel the other person's going to, abandon them, you have any thoughts that the other person is going to abandon them, including the therapist, they can become very angry and lash out. And that's why they are some of the most difficult patients for a therapist. And then they also have transient stress-related paranoid ideation or severe dissociative symptoms. Dissociative symptoms, like what we talked about with dissociative disorders, they can experience depersonalization or derealization kinds of symptoms. Okay, and the paranoid ideation is usually about this person's going to leave me when there's no evidence for that. Okay, so causes of borderline personality disorder. So biological factors include, again, a genetic predisposition, but more generally to both mood disorders and borderline personality disorder, which makes one believe or makes sense given that they share a lot of similar kinds of symptoms, and often those two disorders are misdiagnosed for the other one. And there's also some biological evidence for abnormalities, particularly in the limbic system, which is involved in emotional regulation. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And also irregularities in levels of the neurotransmitter serotonin. And that makes sense because we know serotonin seems to be related to mood disorders. Psychological factors include greater hypersensitivity to emotional cues and words inducing negative feelings, as well as a tendency to experience shame, and thus internalize events more than other people, such that, something goes wrong, the knee-jerk reaction is that was my fault. And cognitive behavioral therapy theorizes that they have an a general schema revolving around the thought, there is something inherently wrong with me, and so I deserve to be mistreated or abandoned. The fact that such a large proportion of people with BPD have suffered severe physical and/or sexual abuse and/or neglect supports such an unhealthy worldview, and also supports the opposing view that it's not necessarily a personality disorder. It's more of a constellation of symptoms, a disorder, and a more of like, an acquired disorder like post-traumatic stress disorder because of the abuse. So very few people with BPD have never experienced any kind of abuse. Most have. Treatments? Well, medical treatments, particularly antidepressants, can be helpful to alleviate the associated symptoms of anxiety and depression. They always experience heightened anxiety and depression, so they can definitely be helpful for that. And mood stabilizers, similar to those for bipolar disorders, that could include antipsychotics and anticonvulsants. Psychological interventions. So here there was a very specific kind of cognitive behavioral therapy intervention developed for this particular personality disorder called dialectical behavior therapy, which was created by Marshall Linehan. And this style of cognitive behavioral therapy tries to change the unhealthy schema and related thoughts, but also to help it tries to help them be less sensitive to others' views of them. Okay, and also teaching them some very practical coping skills that Linehan refers to as emotional regulation skills and distress tolerance skills, which are really behaviors to help deal with times when they're extremely emotionally distressed. Okay, and you really, again, as with all kind of therapy, you want to be challenging that idea that people are always going to be abandoning them, that they're not valuable. Those are really grist for the mill in terms of, changing those unhealthy thoughts and views. And essentially, teaching them to not, react in such dramatic ways, to modify their reactions, that, there aren't just two choices, which is, lashing out at somebody, right? Or thinking that they're the most perfect person in the world. That people have good and bad traits and will treat you well at times and not treat you well at times. They're not all bad or all good. And then the therapist also, by their own practice, can teach boundary can teach about the inappropriateness of boundary crossing behaviors and really discourage that because they typically will cross boundaries with therapists in terms of calling them all hours of the day or, barging in and demanding that they be seen for an appointment. Almost like testing the therapist. Are you going to abandon me if I do these things? Or are you always going to be there for me because I really, really need you and I believe you should always be there for me? So it's like a testing, and that's why they're very difficult patients. And then family systems therapy can also be helpful for changing an unhealthy dynamic and interpersonal pattern between the patient and their parents if we're dealing with, like, let's say, a teenager or so. Okay, this lecture is actually going to be broken up into two parts. So that was part one. We are going to be doing part two shortly after this.